From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, another Nobel Prize win for Boston as three researchers from MIT and Harvard win for their experimental approach to solving global poverty. We'll speak with two of the winners.
This prize was given because I think it's going to make it a little easier to hopefully bring the message of policy based on evidence and hard thinking to many other places as well.
Also today, Senator Elizabeth Warren says she was once fired because she was pregnant. Other women say she is not alone.
People still see pregnancy discrimination and issues facing working mothers as really small or niche and not really part of a national conversation. It's still a concern for every pregnant woman in the workplace that something like this will happen to them.
We'll take your calls. And the MFA is celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Greater Boston can claim three more winners of this year's Nobel Prize. Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee from MIT and Michael Kremer from Harvard won the Nobel Prize in Economics for their experimental approach to solving global poverty. Duflo becomes the award's youngest winner at age 46. She shares the honor with fellow MIT colleague and husband, Banerjee. The couple also co-founded the Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab, or JPAL, at the school. Kremer, the third winner, was in London today. But Duflo and Banerjee are in Cambridge. As we said, they're married. And they told us about getting the call this morning.
Well, we got one call because Esther discovered that I was one of the other awardees and passed the phone to me. We got one call that saved them some breath.
Esther, you're the second woman and the youngest economics laureate ever. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling quite like it's unbelievable. I haven't fully realized it. At the same time, I also realized that the reason that I can get a Nobel Prize while so young is because we are speaking for a movement that is much broader than us and that has swollen in a way faster than even we could have anticipated. So that's the only reason why I get to have a Nobel Prize so young. And I am humbled and delighted and happy to take this for the team.
Abhijit, for our listeners who may not know how the process works, did you know you were in the running, or was the call this morning just a complete surprise for you?
It was a complete surprise. I mean, you know, people will say X is in the running, Y is in the running. My view is that these things, I hear all these stories, I don't believe any of them, I pay no attention to them. I assume that it will be announced and I'll find out who it was, and I had no particular sense that it was even plausible that it would be us this year. So I wasn't paying much attention.
Now, I heard in another interview you gave today that you actually went back to sleep after the phone call. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, it was very early. The person from the Swedish Academy explained that in 45 minutes, there'll be a press conference, and after that, everything is going to become very, very, will become extremely lively. And he was right. So I figured this was my only time.
Very smart. Esther, global poverty, it's a huge problem. I think for a lot of people, it can seem insurmountable. Yet this shared award is, to simplify it, for using experimentation to ask and answer smaller, more manageable questions within this incredibly complex subject. First, is that a reasonable description? And if so, can you give us an example or two of some of the questions you and your teams have looked at?
That's a very reasonable way to describe it. But the point is that if you think poverty in general, that seems to be a very large, very big subject. But if you start looking at it in more detail, it's really a number of problems. Being poor, it's not just about money. It's about not having access to the right kind of education. It's about not being as healthy as you can. It's about not being able to get a job if you're a woman. And once you start thinking about all of these problems one at a time, then you can apply much more rigor and a much more scientific approach to address them. And of course, each of these studies is just one study and illuminates one aspect of the problem. But I was talking earlier about a movement in JPAL, the network that we have created and that we run. There are now 400 researchers who are either affiliates of JPAL or are working with JPAL one way or the other.
400 researchers all around the world?
All around the world. And together they've produced thousands of those studies. And so with thousands of these studies, we get thousand little spotlight on one particular problem, and there are things that we understand much, much better. And in fact, over the last 20 years, many things have gone much better in the lives of the poor worldwide.
Can you give us an example of one of those thousands of studies, one question it asked or one experiment that it attempted?
So, for example, if we want to know how to get parents to immunize their children.
Immunization.
To immunize their children, something which is we know is extremely cost-effective and really saves millions of lives every year, but still there are 25 million children every year who don't get the essential immunization. So how do you change that? So in one particular project, we set up an experiment where we worked in 120 villages with an NGO, and in those half of those villages, the NGO tried to really improve the supply of immunization by supplying regular camps, rain or shine. And so those were 60 centers, and 60 centers got no intervention. And in 30 of those 60 centers, in addition, also randomly chosen, parents got a small reward to bring their kids to the immunization center.
They get like a financial reward?
In this case, a kilo of lentils for each immunization. And after 1 year, you can compare what happens in the 30 villages that got both the lentils and the camps, the 30 villages that got just the camp compared to the one that had the business as usual. And we found some effect of improving the supply, but a much larger effect of adding the small incentives. And so you multiply this by 1,000 and we start having a lot of ideas of what could be done.
That's very helpful. Abhijit, there will be skeptics out there who will say, one can't possibly do enough of those things across the hundreds of millions of people experiencing extreme poverty to make it all work. And yet your team just won a Nobel Prize for suggesting that it can. How does one have faith that all these pieces can come together to fight global poverty on its scale?
So I think one of the things we wrote a book a few years ago called Poor Economics, which was exactly aimed to doing this, is to pull the strings from the various studies and kind of try to understand what the general insight is. So it's true that, you know, each study is one study of one intervention in one place. I mean, the studies are often large. They have often, you know, sometimes even like a million people involved in them. But what I think was very useful, once you have a bunch of studies, you start to see the patterns. For example, one of the patterns, you have people being offered at reasonable prices things that would make their health better. And you discover that they really don't want to pay those prices. The market prices somehow people perceive to be too high. So a general insight from this is that, you know, trying to price kind of these kinds of health goods, things like insecticide treated bed nets or water purification, or in our case immunization, sort of to price it at the market price is kind of hopeless. Then you just miss everybody. No, people aren't willing, for whatever reason, they're not willing to pay for it. So you'll get the insight that you just should start of thinking of, you know, giving things away free, or even giving people a little gift to do them, and not just sitting on the high horse and saying, look, you know, this is good for them, they should just do it. That applies across the board to many, many of these health interventions.
I think it's really possible when the two of you give those examples to begin to see how the behavioral change over time could accumulate to really help fight poverty. Did the two of you or each of you always know that you wanted to take this small pieces experimental approach, or was there a moment when you thought, we've been doing this wrong, we need to do something differently?
We have a lot of moments where we thought we were doing something in particular wrong, and we were not thinking about a particular problem the right way. But I think we never had a doubt that the approach of going slowly, piece by piece, problem by problem, brick by brick, was the wrong one. We strongly believe in that one. The great advantage of working in this way is that even if we get something wrong, and we do all the time, then we feel, okay, we can move on to the next problem and do better.
You've spoken about this network of scholars all over the world who are working on the same problems, passionate to use the same approaches. You and your colleague, Michael Kremer, have won a Nobel Prize. What does that mean for the entire community of scholars doing this kind of work?
It's a huge endorsement for the whole community. We're lucky to be where we are. We happen to be at the beginning of this movement, and we get some reflected glory from that. And I think it's great that this recognition has come, but it's a recognition for this whole body of work, the way this entire field of development economics, which was so much based on general principles and received wisdom, has changed. It's much more of a live place where people have hypotheses. The hypotheses are pretty sophisticated. They test those hypotheses. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. And then you evolve your hypothesis, you come to yet another possibility. That the sense of, you know, quick and nimble learning is extremely exciting, and it's something that we want to share with the rest of the world. So if this buys us, you know, more ears in the world, that I hope will benefit the entire community. And in particular, I know that it will benefit the whole entire community, because there's so many young and excited people who are great researchers who will see the new opportunities created by it and go and do the new work that's going to be even more interesting and exciting.
The total prize is about $900,000, split among the two of you and Professor Kremer. Any thoughts on how you might use that prize money?
When Marie Curie and her husband got the Nobel Prize, the first one for Marie Curie, they bought a gram of radium with the money. And when I found out this story, I was 8 or 9, and I thought this was fabulous, that they would put the achievement of a career back and plow it back to their work. So I think we are going to try and find whatever is the equivalent in our work of the gram of radium.
That is Professors Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee, economists from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They, along with Professor Michael Kremer from Harvard, jointly won the Nobel Prize in Economics today. Thank you to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk about the balance between pregnancy and work. And we'll take your calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Ticiana Deering. Hang on, there's more Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Ticiana Deering. Senator Elizabeth Warren has said she was fired from a teaching job in 1971 for being pregnant. Here's the Massachusetts senator and Democratic presidential candidate talking about that experience with CBS News.
I was 6 months pregnant. It was my first job. I was 22 years old. And the job that was mine, that I'd been hired for the next year, was taken away when they knew I was pregnant.
After a conservative news site targeted Warren's depiction of her experience, hundreds of women took to social media to talk about their own experiences with pregnancy discrimination, showing that Warren's experience was neither unique nor out of date. Joining us in the studio to talk more about this is Emma Quinn Judge, who's a partner at Zalkin, Duncan & Bernstein, an employment law firm in Boston. Emma, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Catherine Goldstein, creator and host of the Double Shift podcast and contributor to Cognoscenti, WBUR's ideas and opinion page. Catherine joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Hello, Catherine.
Hi there.
And Catherine, I just want to note to our listeners, I believe you contributed to a WBUR Cognoscenti piece just last week that collected and told a lot of local women's discrimination stories, correct?
Yes.
Now, we'll get to our panelists in a minute, but first, how about you? Have you experienced pregnancy or maternal discrimination at work? What did you do about it? Or are you a business owner thinking about how you're going to balance maternity leave or parental obligations with your own company's needs? We invite you to join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, back to our panelists now. Let me just begin by asking you, what was your reaction to Elizabeth Warren's story about her own firing, Emma?
I think it's incredibly credible, and I think it's the sort of story that we see in different forms today. Pregnancy discrimination, unlike many other forms of discrimination, remains something that people do openly. You know, an employee can tell their supervisor they're pregnant and be fired the next week. That remains the case today, and it's pervasive. We see that women of color, for example, are disproportionately affected by it. But really, you see it across all job levels in different forms, from blatant to more subtle.
And you've really seen this basically your entire career. Is that right, Emma?
Certainly. It's nothing new. It's been around. What's changing in Massachusetts is the legal protections have certainly increased in the last few years. We've had a couple of new laws, one of which hasn't quite gone into place yet. We'll have paid family leave starting in 2021. But the protections for workers in Massachusetts are really fantastic right now. I think what there needs to be more of is education and familiarity with the laws, both for employees and employers.
And I'm hoping that in a little bit later in the conversation, we'll get more into detail about what laws and protections are in place now. First, Catherine, I want to turn to you. It's kind of an interesting moment. You had a 2018 op-ed for the New York Times shortly after sort of the spark of the hashtag MeToo movement. And you actually wrote then that you were kind of waiting for some similar big moment or big story to break that would push this out into the open and push out into view our treatment of mothers in the workplace. Is this that moment? Is this the moment you were looking for or waiting for?
So in my New York Times op-ed, I did posit when would we have a hashtag moms too moment? And that was about a year and a half ago. And I would say this is the closest we've gotten so far to the moms too moment. And I think it's very I think it's a very powerful moment because personally, as a journalist who covers these issues and who has cares very deeply about the status of mothers in the workplace, I'm so thrilled that this is being talked about on the national stage. Basically, pregnancy discrimination has really been seen as a niche issue. It has been seen as something that really just affects a very small group of people. It's maybe a few bad bosses rather than a systemic problem that affects I think many mothers' careers and really affects all women in the workplace. So I think that this is definitely the spark of the perhaps the spark of the moms too moment. And I was thinking back about Anita Hill, you know, when she came forward with her stories, people eviscerated her, but it did end up with a lot of more people filing complaints. And so hopefully we'll continue to hear more and more stories about why this is a problem.
That was her story of sexual harassment from Clarence Thomas that was sort of aired at the Senate hearings for the Supreme Court justice. That's, I'm assuming, what you're referring to?
Yes.
All right. I'd like to take a call. We've got our first call in 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation, share your stories, ask questions of our panelists. Jennifer from Templeton is calling. Jennifer, what is your story?
Hi. I have one daughter, and I was working in a retail establishment when I went into labor as a manager already there. I had my daughters 3.5 weeks early. My water broke right in the store, and I found out years later that the only reason I was able to keep my job when I went back 6 weeks later instead of a full 2 months like my doctor had wanted was because my store manager and my assistant store manager blatantly ignored my district manager telling them to hire a new manager to take my spot.
How long ago was this, Jennifer?
My daughter just turned 8.
So not that long ago, really.
No, not at all. This was September 5th, 2011 is when I went into labor.
Jennifer, thanks for the call. I saw Emma. Emma, you visibly winced at one point during Jennifer's story. So let me invite your reaction.
I think one of the things that's challenging about pregnancy in the workplace is just how personal it is, that you have these very personal moments in front of your colleagues. And so the story of someone really going into labor in the workplace brings home how you can't separate your personal life, your private life, from your work life, even though I think for women they face this double bind of needing to be perceived as both a good worker and a good mother, and sometimes employers view those as incompatible. We need to learn to coexist. We need to learn to find some harmony between those two sides, and I think the law allows for that, but I just think that story really illustrates the personal nature of this. This is not just about work.
And let me ask you, had Jennifer's employer terminated her as a result of that, would that have been legal to do 8 years ago?
No. I mean, pregnancy discrimination or gender discrimination, which is linked to pregnancy discrimination, was illegal 8 years ago in Massachusetts. It was illegal federally and has been since the 70s when Congress overturned a Supreme Court decision actually saying that pregnancy discrimination wasn't gender discrimination. So certainly it wouldn't be legal to fire someone merely because they have had a child. And that's been the case for decades.
So, Catherine, did Jennifer's story resonate with you? Have you heard other stories like that since you've been working on the double shift? I know you talk to a lot of women in the workplace.
When I published my New York Times op-ed, my inbox was flooded with stories like Jennifer's. And unfortunately, I think people often, I agree with your assessment that this is sort of a problem at all levels of all professions. But I think people who work in lower paid positions in retail or food service, jobs like that, are often sort of seen as the most disposable and have really, really terrible stories. And as Jennifer mentioned, she was planning to go back to work 2 months after giving birth. Well, you know, both economists and maternal and child health experts would recommend much longer time. And in America, we've really normalized these incredibly short maternity leaves. And I think that sort of heightens that, you know, people are not ready to go back to work at 6 weeks or 2 months. And we've kind of made that the norm. And we want to fire people for, you know, not coming back even sooner. And so I hope that we can have a much larger conversation about how all of these pieces fit together and how we treat mothers in the workplace.
Emma, you talked about the paid leave legislation that's going to come into effect in 2020 here in Massachusetts. Will that affect how long a woman can take or a man can take when their family has a new child?
So Massachusetts already has a parental leave law that sort of sets the floor. Employers can do more, but that allows people a minimum of 8 weeks of unpaid leave. The Family Medical Leave Act won't necessarily change that amount of leave, although it does allow people up to 26 weeks per year for a variety of reasons that can be stacked together. So caring for a family member versus your own medical needs. And so I think certainly in the case of if you're giving birth, there might be a medical leave component for yourself and then a component of a leave where you'd be caring for a family member. I think what's really important about the law, which will start to allow paid parental leave in 2021, is that it will provide some income substitution, because at the federal and state level, what we have right now is laws that allow for unpaid leave, which a lot of people just can't afford to take, men or women. And so having some level of income substitution will open up the possibility of paid leave for a much broader number of people.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you'd like to join the conversation. Have you experienced discrimination in the workplace because of pregnancy or because you had small children? On the other hand, have you interviewed somebody, an employee for a job, and found yourself taking into consideration whether or not that person was likely to have children later? And how did that affect your thinking? Or do you think you were that person on the other side of an interview? Call us and share your questions, your thoughts, your experiences. Again, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Catherine, in listening to you and Emma, one of the things that I find myself thinking about, when the hashtag MeToo movement began, there was very quickly an understanding that maybe this was a movement of privileged white women who could both afford to speak up and who had the resources to do something about it. I've heard both you and Emma talk about people who are less enfranchised, people who have less work flexibility, people who can't afford, for example, to take unpaid leave. What does it take to have solidarity across all workers who might be experiencing this? And what do we need to understand to sort of enfranchise everybody into experiencing or fighting for their rights?
So I would say that I think this is, you know, paid family leave and being treated fairly in the workplace is a universal human right. And I agree that a lot of times the people who do take legal action or really are standing up for themselves are the ones who have the most privilege because they can, you know, they can sort of afford to take those risks, or they're, you know, not as worried about where their next paycheck is going to come from. So they're more willing to speak up. Some encouraging examples I have seen in my reporting is that I think people are seeing family leave especially as not just, you know, something that they should negotiate for themselves, but how they should be able to make their whole company better for everyone. And we're seeing this with some big companies like Walmart and some other very large employers have had two different systems for their family leave. The executives get very generous packages, and the store workers and the, you know, people who are working on the floor get almost nothing. So people are starting to challenge that. And I think, you know, people who have more privilege needs to bring other people in their companies and communities along with them, including for advocating for state policies and federal policies.
Emma, it may not be as clear in the moment in a workplace environment as, oh, you're pregnant, you're fired, or, oh, you're pregnant, you don't get the job. What are some of the more implicit ways that discrimination in this area can happen?
So there can be stereotypes about women, and a lot of this is often linked to their caregiving roles. I think pregnancy is inextricably linked to stereotypes about what women should do as mothers. So you may see the slightly more subtle forms are when a woman returns to work after leave, her job responsibilities may change. You may also see a form of benevolent sexism where employers think they're doing what's right for the woman. You don't want to work on this high-profile account because you've just had a baby. It's going to be too stressful for you. You don't want to travel because you've just had a baby. You don't want to work nights, maybe if you're in a job where there are better tips in the evening. And that takes away choice from women, and it's often done from a vantage point of I'm helping you.
It's not mean-spirited. I mean, at one level, don't you want your employer thinking thoughtfully and compassionately about your needs as a person who both has a family and works?
Right. And so where you run into a problem is that your employer is taking choice away from you. You know, the employer needs to treat you as a fully fledged human being who can make these decisions for yourself. And if you can make these decisions for yourself, you can decide what you want to do in your career and what's appropriate for your family. There's a case that went through the court system around here several years ago where an employer didn't promote someone and said, you know, when you look back on this, you'll feel good that we made this decision for you. And the interviewer is looking at your situation. I mean, you have these triplets. Really, we feel overwhelmed imagining what your life is like. So you'll feel better that we didn't give you this promotion. And so what the law says is you can't make those choices for women. Women get to make their own choices. And it may be that you want to go to your employer and say, I don't want to travel for the first 6 months after I come back to work after having a baby.
But that has to be your choice.
And that's a conversation, exactly. It's your choice. But you don't want people making those choices for you.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Kevin from Marblehead, go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I think this is a great conversation. Thanks so much. This discrimination that has taken place obviously needs to be talked about. But I read something in the Boston Globe recently that spoke, and I'm actually not a big supporter of the senator, and that's why I read this article.
Senator Warren, you mean?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
And I know that the first commenter there had said that it was a very credible story. But my understanding of it is that when she was at Harvard, she described a situation quite different than actually what happened. So I don't want to deter from this conversation that this has been brought on by what Senator Warren said, but I think the actuality of what took place might be a little bit of sensationalism by her own words back several years when she talked about her early career.
Thanks for that call, Kevin. And I'm going to turn to Catherine on this. Catherine, I think Kevin's referring to a speech that Elizabeth Warren gave in 2007 where she spoke about that time in her life and talked about the decision a different way. When somebody has experienced discrimination, do they... So, one, what do you think of the merits of Kevin's comments? And two, do we expect a person to speak about that instance the same way over time?
So in my experiences, hearing from a lot of women who have experienced discrimination similar to Senator Warren, a lot of times people are embarrassed. They feel like they've done something wrong. They feel ashamed. And, you know, saying you got, you know, you lost your job because you were pregnant doesn't always sound great on your resume. You know, people want to put a more positive spin on their work experiences and their lives because it's tough to talk about. And also people, like we've seen with Senator Warren, people don't believe you. You know, regardless of what evidence there is, I think we're still in a moment where, although I think this idea of believe women is very powerful, there's still a lot of skepticism met with these kinds of claims, as we're hearing from Kevin and others who were not totally sure about her account.
And I do want to note, Catherine, just before you go on, we don't 100% know what happened in that moment.
Right. This is, you know, nearly 50 years ago. Some of the key players are no longer alive. We have a few little pieces of evidence. So I would not say that I know 100% for sure exactly what happened. I would say based on her description and experiences of many of her contemporaries, I think this is a highly plausible description. And it's also highly plausible that not everyone always feels comfortable talking about these things, and especially in a different era. Even 10 years ago, I think there was less understanding or appreciation for this. I think there was less understanding and appreciation for this 3 years ago. So that part doesn't raise my concerns as much as perhaps it does for Kevin.
I want to get another call in here. Marilyn from Newton is on the line. Marilyn, go ahead.
Hello. I am very interested in this program, and I really agree with the idea that you are presenting in the program of women who are pregnant or who are near giving birth. But I was thinking about my father's business maybe about 20, 30 years ago, and about all small business owners. He was a small business owner, very successful with the small business. And this was a bakery. And if he had, if the person who did the cake frosting and molding some of the cakes that he sold had suddenly had to leave, or even had given him word of leaving, it would have been a slight problem if she gave him word on time. If she had to do it because
of maternity leave, Marilyn, is that what you're thinking?
Excuse me?
If she had to do it because of maternity leave?
No. Yes, maternity leave. What my question is this. I'm sorry to have taken so long. What happens to the employer of a small business where really it counts very much to have people in place you can depend on?
Yeah.
Because it went when the employer.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, Marilyn, but I want to. We got a lot of calls. I think we know the direction of your question, and I want to give our panelists a chance to address it. Catherine, Emma, the employer, it's a small business. They're paying two salaries. That is a huge stretch. Is that not a legitimate concern, a legitimate claim?
So in Massachusetts, the leave requirement is actually unpaid. So employers may pay people when they go on leave, but they can go on leave for 8 weeks that's unpaid. So you're not necessarily paying two salaries.
But you may be losing an experienced employee who is more productive than the person you'd substitute with.
Certainly. And so our laws do cover any employers that have six or more employees. And frankly, even if you have fewer employees in Massachusetts, there are other civil rights laws that would probably protect you against sex discrimination. So we've made a public policy decision as a state that we are going to protect people in these situations. Now, there's the issue of someone going out on leave, but there's also what happens before someone goes out on leave. They may need accommodations. They may need more breaks. They may need to sit. They may need to carry a water bottle, all those sorts of things. One of our newer laws, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Protection Act, allows for people to seek those accommodations, and there's an interactive process that they're supposed to have with their employer around those accommodations. It's supposed to be a real dialogue, and the employer is supposed to accommodate them unless it creates a hardship, an undue hardship. And so
for
that's
the employer.
Exactly. And so that is the point where you look at the size of the business, and what's an undue hardship for a multi-million-dollar corporation is going to be different from what an undue hardship is for an employer who has 10 employees. But really, we've made a public policy decision that although there may be costs associated, it is to everybody's benefit to provide these rights for pregnant workers. Pregnancy is, you know, it's a blip in a woman's career if she works from 20 into her 60s or 70s. It's a brief moment, and it shouldn't derail her career. And that's the decision we've made in the law.
Catherine, in reality, have you heard stories where even though it's a blip and maybe there were legal protections, it did derail a career, it did provide substantial impact on the trajectory of a woman's professional life?
Definitely. I think many, many people really that I have talked to have really been felt that their pregnancy or becoming a mother really derailed them. And, you know, we see a lot of moms who go on to start their own small businesses or sort of take a step out of the workforce. And a lot of times we frame that as a choice, but a lot of times it's because, you know, because they weren't in a workplace that could possibly support them or was openly hostile or they faced a lot of these challenges. I think that the answer around small business really is that it's not fair to the small business owner to have to shoulder these burdens, which is why we need policies like you all are developing in Massachusetts. And we also need federally mandated paid family leave for everyone, because a lot of the workforce is moving away from even being employed full time. Freelancers are becoming a huge part of the economy. And we have to think creatively about how to support everyone, regardless of what kind of employer they work for, so we don't have a situation of the haves and the have-nots when it comes to this kind of treatment.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left, so I'm going to ask you each one brief question. Emma, to you, what's the next step legally or in terms of policy to improve the relationship between working parents and their employers?
I think we have great laws in place in Massachusetts, and I really think it's a process of education. One of the things that our Parental Leave Act requires is that employers post policies conspicuously. And that may sound like a small thing, but if you're a pregnant woman going to your boss to tell your boss that you are pregnant, that's usually a pretty scary moment. And just knowing what your rights are, just knowing what the framework for that conversation is a great starting point. That's one of the provisions of the law that I find is often overlooked, but can have a big difference in terms of how a woman experiences that conversation. I also think employers should be really trying to create a welcoming culture for parents. Part of that is not just working with employees who are seeking leave, but also their coworkers, not dumping work on coworkers, which breeds a lot of resentment. But I really think education is the biggest area we can improve on in Massachusetts.
And Catherine, is it time to extend this storytelling and this opportunity to share your experiences with parents who are not women?
Absolutely. In my research and reporting, I've found that the best way to reduce sexism in the workplace against women is to give and have men take a robust paternity leave. It actually improves their relationships with their own children, and it increases their sensitivity to working mothers in the workplace. So I do not think this is an issue that just affects mothers, and I would like to see fathers both taking their paternity leave and sort of getting more involved in this cause and not seeing it as just a niche issue that only mothers are fighting for.
That's Catherine Goldstein, creator and host of the Double Shift podcast and a contributor to Cognoscenti. Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you.
And Emma Quinn Judge, a partner at Zellkind, Duncan & Bernstein, an employment law firm in Boston. Thanks so much, Emma.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. You're hearing the Iron River Singers at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston this morning. The MFA, as well as multiple cities and towns across Massachusetts, are celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day today. It's part of a national movement by Native American tribes and activists to rename Columbus Day. Now, in a minute, we'll hear from the head of community engagement at the MFA. But first, let's listen to a bit of a conversation we had earlier with Jean-Luc Pirite. He's the board president of the North American Indian Center of Boston. We caught him on his cell phone between events at the MFA. He started by saying that 5 years ago, he couldn't have imagined so many places recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day.
I feel a sense of solidarity, and not so much because of what's happening from the institution standpoint, but we are actually seeing the diversity of our community. We are seeing people coming from Peru, from Panama. They are coming to our tables and talking about issues within their own countries. So we're seeing just kind of like this coming together of like-minded people, and we're seeing sort of like the political nature of Indigenous Peoples Day.
So, Jean-Luc, the MFA and other cultural institutions, other museums, have a fraught legacy with colonialism, with excluding people of color. We know that in the case of the MFA, there was a specific incident earlier this year, a racist incident with young people from the public schools. What role should our cultural institutions play in dealing with what is a colonial heritage?
So part of the conversation did come about as a result of what happened with the students of color at the MFA. But I have to say that another piece of the conversation is actually being reflected at the Massachusetts State House right now. There is a bill called the Protect Native Heritage Bill, and this deals with the process of how museums deacquisition our sacred objects and artwork from our artisans. And so when we talk about the complexities and what it means for our relationship and decolonization of art institutions, tribal consultation is key. How museums actually categorize and recognize the provenance of these objects within their collections, but then also treating our work as actual legitimate art and not coming from a Western perspective. So there are many different things that actually can happen at art institutions to decolonize themselves, and it starts within the institution itself. But we also need legislative measures to help support the advocacy that we're doing.
That was Jean-Luc Pirit, board president of the North American Indian Center of Boston. Let's turn now to Makeba McCreary. She's the chief of learning and community engagement at the MFA. She's on the line. Makeba, welcome.
Hello.
Hi there. So, Makeba, take us into the MFA today. What is happening in the museum around Indigenous Peoples Day?
I would say the first thing is that we have invited artists and professional scholars and all sorts of folks who actually come from Native communities and have agreed, and I think we're really honored that they've agreed to come and share space with us and to bring their gifts. And so here there's been incredible music, there's been dancing, there's been gallery talks, there's been some challenge of our collection and the interpretation. It's really run the gamut.
Today is an important day, Makeba. It is one day. And as you heard, Jean-Luc Pirit was talking about the role of institutions like the MFA and all their cultural institutions in reckoning with the colonial past. So after today, how do you see the MFA's responsibility to the communities whose heritages are on display there?
That's right. Part of the work that I have taken on is to ask that question not just about Indigenous Peoples Day, but also Martin Luther King Day and Lunar New Year and Nowruz. These are all moments where we are somehow really inviting to a community that otherwise doesn't find themselves here on other days. And I think the key to changing that really is in thinking about interpretation, inviting in other voices, allowing our narratives to be challenged. History is really embedded in these pieces of art, objects of art in our collection tells one story, but there's an opportunity for us to allow many other stories to enter that universe. And so I think the more that we open our doors, the more that we are willing to be vulnerable in that process, and the more that we truly honor and celebrate the really rich histories that surround us and that are within the collection, we'll get there. We will continue to get there. But it has to happen on a daily basis, and to your point, not just one day out of the year.
So, Makeba, to this point of opening your doors and embracing some vulnerability, do you see the art world evolving, becoming sort of more complete or more global in terms of how it identifies who makes art and what fine art is?
I can really only speak to my experience here at the MFA, and I can tell you that since I got here in January, the efforts that have changed are truly found when you are sort of listening in a gallery and you're watching people interact with the different exhibitions, and you hear people walk into Ancient Nubia Now and say, oh my gosh, I have never seen my people represented in this way, and our work is incredible. It's legacy building, and why hasn't anyone told this story before? Those are the moments that I think happen more and more, and the more that happens, there's evidence that we are getting there and we are getting to the right place.
Makiba, the MFA is such an iconic institution in Boston. The city itself doesn't officially recognize Indigenous Peoples Day. Cambridge and Brookline do, but Boston doesn't. Does that somehow give the MFA an extra responsibility to provide recognition?
I don't think it's just the MFA's responsibility, but yes, we accept that and we embrace it and we celebrate it. But I think every cultural institution, academic institutions, we all have a responsibility to make sure that we are honoring the individuals that use our space and that we're actually here to serve. And so everybody plays a part in this, and I think we all should be taking a position on this topic and others as well, but collectively, and I think we have a lot to learn from each other.
You said, I really want to zero in on this phrase you used of, you know, we're here to serve. How do you see this concept of service for the MFA in terms of both, again, you know, reckoning with its own colonial past, but also embracing the vibrancy of, you know, multicultural Boston?
Yeah, I was just having this conversation not too long ago with somebody. The beauty, right, of this museum is it's encyclopedic and it holds in it, you know, decades and decades of histories that are found in objects of art. And the question is, for whom were those stories created and to who did those objects belong? And at one point in time, it probably didn't look very much like the current population of the city of Boston. And we've taken a little bit too long to respond to our current public and to our citizens, but we're ready to do that now, and I think we're moving forward aggressively. That's the work, is to acknowledge that the people who we are here to serve, because our doors are open and they should be inviting and welcoming to everybody, this institution should feel like it belongs to everybody in the city. And we're not there yet, but we are going to get there. And I think it's with moments like this where we decide that we are going to take a position and really step into a space that, I said before, allows us to be vulnerable. It also allows us to grow and learn from other people as well.
Let's talk about the complexity of Columbus Day. It has a vexed history, to put it simply. Mm-hmm. It remains especially important to many Italian-American communities in this country and in Boston. The MFA is celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day today. It's an interesting tension, Makiba. What do you say to critics who argue that supplanting Columbus Day ignores a different historically marginalized group, that is Italian-Americans, especially here in Boston?
Sure. I say it can't be a zero-sum game. I said that in my career in education as well. Just because one student is able to access a high-quality education doesn't mean that another student should be denied that. I think the same is true when you acknowledge a community and a culture. It really should not preclude you from also acknowledging and honoring a culture that perhaps has some significance on that similar moment in time. So we've got to find ways to share space, and I think that's my approach to that work. And I would invite others to think about that as well.
The MFA, I think, arguably has actively pursued a reckoning in the last several of months. When doing that in large, how do you think about managing the tension of competing groups with competing histories and competing claims?
I don't think there's anything to manage. I think the reality is that we are here to serve the community of Boston. We're here to serve our international visitors. And every family, every child should feel like they are welcome to come into this museum and be a part of our community. And so anything that we do to create barriers for that, it's our work to remove those barriers and to figure out how to become the most inclusive environment possible. You know, I see that as an inviting opportunity. I don't know. It's certainly challenging in how much you have to deconstruct, and a lot of it's invisible at this. In this day, we have a lot of those barriers that I don't know that we've even acknowledged. And so we also need to make sure that we're open enough that folks will come and say to us, hey, you know, there's some things that are happening here that don't make me feel like my culture is really being honored in the way that I would want to participate.
And Makiba, do you feel like today's events have been a success for the MFA and for people who wanted to come and celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day?
I mean, absolutely. If you just walk through the Shapiro Courtyard or into any of the galleries where you just see the incredible diversity of this city, but also some truth-telling. You know, we've had some incredible guests who have been speaking to all of our visitors about those two sort of, you know, conflicting moments where we have been a part as a museum of denying a certain history and not acknowledging even the lands that we are on, to today actually honoring the lands that we are on as, you know, not being that of our own. And we're thrilled. It's just been wonderful.
That is Makeba McCreary, Chief of Learning and Community Engagement at the MFA. Thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tisiana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.